Okay, so tonight is class number, lesson number 11, and we probably be a little shorter than usual, but we are going to talk about five different little topics here. We're in the actually 1500 through the 1800, kind of. We're going to talk about the age of wandering, the wandering Jews. We're going to talk a little bit about Poland, as it originally was a short-term haven of peace for the Jewish people. Then we'll talk about the Chmielnicki massacres. Mo was nervous with this guy because he was really instrumental in killing a lot of Jews, and my name almost fits inside his, Olivier Melnyk, Chmielnicki massacres. I don't like his name because it's almost like mine. Shabbatai Tzvi is the, we're going to talk about Shabbatai Tzvi after that, and then we'll touch a little bit on Hasidic Judaism. So, following the first topic here is the Age of Wandering. Following the 15th century's expulsions from France, England, Spain, and Portugal, the Jewish people found themselves wandering. Now, this is not something new. There is a there is a stigma attached to the Jewish people across the centuries as the wandering Jews. They don't have a country to call their own. Of course, since 1948, modern Israel changed that, even though Israel always was their country to call their own, but was not. They didn't live there like they do now. The wandering, at this time of history, there's a lot of wandering, a lot of expulsions from different countries of Europe. Remember, we're at the tail end of the expulsions out of Spain, the big one after the Inquisition, and out of Portugal. They've already been expelled from France and England several times, back and forth. So following those expulsions, if not confined to a few ghettos, like we saw last week, the first ghetto being in the Venice district of the foundry district of Venice, if not confined to a few ghettos, the Jewish population started to migrate eastward, where there seemed to be an environment more peaceful and more conducive to settling down. Believe it or not, as bad as it got for them in Eastern Europe with the pogroms and the Holocaust and the camps, originally it was a place where Jewish people could find some peace and start a semblance of normal life. So that's why that migration took place. It took many Jews towards the Balkans and Poland and Turkey and Israel even. But Poland in particular became a place of refuge and saw a tremendous influx of Jewish people at that time. Now, what's interesting, at the same time, in France and England, in spite of the expulsions, that anti-Semitism continued to flourish. When you have a country that continues to breed anti-Semitism, yet there's almost no Jewish people left in that country, you have to ask yourself a question: how sick are they? Today, we have a little bit of this in Poland. There's almost no Jew left in Poland, yet Poland is still very anti-Semitic. France is still very anti-Semitic. England is still very anti-Semitic today. But it's interesting here, France and in England, anti-Semitism continued to flourish. In the words of historian Leon Poliakov, he was quoted saying, where the Jew did not exist, he was invented. That's what happened in France and England. When you think about it now, and I said this in the earlier session, and I got to be careful when I said, because I don't want to be dogmatic. This is not something I can be dogmatic about. But sometimes I wonder, the two communities in Europe that really have collapsed under Islam are France and England. They're taken over by Islam more than any other Western European countries. And here we have the two countries back in those days that were really rejecting the Jews and continued to be anti-Semitic beyond Jewish presence within their borders. So you start to wonder, is this can we apply the concept of Genesis 12:3 to those two countries? I will bless those who bless you and curse him who curses you. That's possible. We can't be dogmatic about it, and I don't want to be dogmatic, but I'm just, I just asked a question. That's a possibility. I raised a question. I don't know that we can answer this for sure. Anti-Semitic teachings and propaganda continue to appear in catechism, different Catholic catechisms and teachings and books. So even some secondhand peddlers in France, I believe, were even harassed and accused of being Jewish. That's the amazing. We are several centuries after the myth of the greedy Jew that was developed during the Middle Ages. Yet, and there's not that many Jewish people in France and England at that time. And you find people, peddlers and street merchants, and when their dealings with their customers are not satisfactory to the customers, the first thing that happens is that they're accused of being Jewish because the transaction was not to the customer's satisfaction. So we go back to the greedy Jew who wants to control the world and who wants to make more money. And yet there's almost no Jewish people in those countries at that time. Literature was not exempt from anti-Semitic diatribes. French writer Pascal understood and taught that the fate of the wandering Jew was a proof of Christianity. In other words, the Jew was going to be wandering and never settle down anywhere because they were guilty of killing God or killing the Lord, which is, of course, not biblical. It's not true. What's interesting, when I reflect on all these French writers, poets, philosophers, humanists of that period of time, all those that I studied when I was a kid in France, we never heard one thing about their anti-Semitic writings or their position on Jewish people. That was never, I mean, we would study, I mean, as a kid, I learned poems and read books by some pretty anti-Semitic people. I had no idea. So as a Jewish boy here, and back then I'm sure people knew, but it was not part of what we talked about. So I'm revisiting history and some famous people in Europe and in France, and I'm going like, wow, I read his books, I studied this guy, and then I had no idea. So it's a little eerie for me to go back and revisit history and find all those names that I had in my history books and my French literature book. Another voice of anti-Semitism out of France at that time was Jacques Bossuet. He was bishop and a theologian under Louis XIV. The Catholic Church, to this day, consider him as one of the greatest preachers of all times, better and even better than John Chrysostom or Augustine. He was a Louis XIV court preacher. He was his personal priest or preacher. He probably had a court jester and he had a court preacher. Come talk to me about God. That guy would come, Jacques Bossuet, who's very famous in France. There's like a metro station. There's a buildings and streets about after his name. He was considered better preacher than Chrysostom, who was also a blatant anti-Semite. And Chrysostom was known as the golden mouth orator. So Jacques Bossuet had a very, if you ask the Catholic Church, they would speak very highly of him and remember nothing of his, or remember but choose not to discuss anything about his anti-Semitism. In one of his sermons, in many of his sermons, and in one of his famous works titled "The Discours sur l'histoire universelle," Discourse on Universal History, he paints the Jews as an accursed and hardened race, hated by God and in misery for their deicide, monstrous people that has neither hearth nor home, without country and scattered in all countries, once the happiest of the world, and now the butt of every fancy, the object of hatred of the whole world. In their misery, wrought by divine malediction, they are the laughing stock of all sensible people. So this is the greatest preacher of all time out of France said things like this. England also was not very favorable to the Jews at the time. England under Oliver Cromwell was no better. When the Jewish community had been expelled in 1290, now I'm sure there were a few Jews in England, probably not that many, but remember now, being Jewish back then, you didn't have reform, conservative, orthodox, secular, reconstructionist, messianic. You had Jewish. Okay, you were a Jew, you kept kosher, you went to shul on Saturday, on Friday night, on Saturday, in the synagogue. You kept the dietary laws, you kept as much as the Mosaic laws you could. So what I'm saying here is, like, it was extremely difficult, if not impossible, for a Jewish family to survive on their own. If a Jewish community would move, the whole community would go with them, because you'd have the kosher butcher, the kosher baker, the synagogue or synagogues, the rabbis, the school. Everything would kind of move to a different location. So when the Jews were expelled from one country, unless a few were completely assimilated, or they were like crypto Jews, or you know what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, the Maranos and the Conversos of Spain, most of them would move at the same time. In 1290, it happened in England, and when they tried to come back in 1655, it was eventually faced with a lot of opposition from the masses, and the Maranos were actually the only ones that were eventually allowed back in London. Just a small portion of the Jewish people. Of course, if you remember, the Maranos means pigs. They were the Jewish converts to Catholicism under the Inquisition. Some of them were real converts, some of them were not. But these Maranos were the only one invited back into England at that time. So England and France still had a very strong policy against the Jewish people. So we get some people in the ghetto in Italy or in Germany and a few other places in Western Europe. They don't particularly like that life. Some people want to go back to France. They really are not welcome that much. Some people want to go back to England. They're not really welcome that much. So there is going to be a mass migration to Eastern Europe, which seems to be right now the place for the Jewish people to go to. That's why we have this migration to Poland in particular. Against the backdrop of multiple expulsions and ghettoization, I'm not sure it's a word, Poland appeared as the only substantial ray of hope for the Jews. It wouldn't last forever, but Poland offered the Jewish community a haven of peace that allowed them social and spiritual growth like nowhere else. They're actually going to really, really grow and get involved in society at every level, in government, in schools, and it's going to be quite good for Jewish people at that time for a while. That's a good question. Well, the anti-Semitism, well, it didn't last very long, okay? But one of the reasons why it was accepted is they were protected by the kings. And if you're protected by the kings, you'll see. Well, let me go into the rest of the notes, because I explain why. One reason why, basically, that they brought with them they helped the economy. So they brought with them some of their wealth, and I got to be careful now when I say the Jews brought with them some of their wealth. I'm not saying that they own the world, and when I say that, I feel guilty and self-conscious when I say the Jews brought some of their wealth. You know, not that any of you would be anti-Semitic, but that's the kind of statement that when I say this, I'm going like, somebody is going to misunderstand what I'm saying and think like the Jews own everything and we're greedy. No, that's not what I mean by that. But some of their property, and let me go into through the notes here. It had started in the Middle Ages, actually, when German Jews, escaping the Crusades and the blood libel and the Black Death and the Inquisition, started to massively migrate eastward towards Poland and Lithuania. The refugees were very well received and accepted, as their immigration created an economic boom for the local economy. They brought with them not only some of their wealth, but also some very capable people. Doctors, lawyers, people that would actually have connection with the courts and would be connected, would have some great trades and some knowledge. A lot of philosophers and writers, and so they brought a lot with them, much more than just money. Okay, And that was really a great boost for the economy. They were accepted in all areas of government and business. It was not long before they would be accepted by the kings and the nobles of Poland. Yet, they were never accepted by the clergy and, of course, the people. So there is still a shift here. The kings and the nobles of Poland see an advantage to the growth of their country, and they're going to protect the Jews to an extent, to a great extent, actually, at the beginning. But the clergy and the people, the clergy basically, still holding on to the Christ killer mentality that basically started with the early church fathers. Just developed over the centuries, they're still clinging to that. They want the Jews gone, and the clergy is driving the masses. The people are coming to masses, as in not mass, but the people. The people are coming to the church. They're hearing the sermons, and so the clergy, basically the popes, not all the popes, but some of the popes, the monks, the bishops, they are basically driving the agenda, and they want to get rid of the Jewish people. So there is a conflict between clergy and people and kings and nobles. The clergy was particularly concerned by the preferential treatment that the kings gave the Jews, and they worked hard at trying to impose the canonical laws against the Jewish people. You remember we talked about two major codes, the Theodician Code of 400 and something, I forgot the exact date, and then later on the Justinian Code that picked up on the Theodician Code. And those codes basically, if you remember when we discussed them, they instituted a lot of different laws. They added laws. They took rights away from Jewish people. The Jewish people could not own Christian slaves anymore, could not mingle with Christians, could not celebrate some of the Christian holidays, could not go on the byways of Europe. And every time they would add more and add more laws and take away more rights from the Jewish people. So the clergy in Poland pretty quickly wanted to reinstitute some of those canonical laws against the Jewish people that had pretty much not been forgotten, but they were not being enforced at that time as much as they were when they first came out. By the end of the 15th century, a ghetto was introduced in Krakow in Poland, and persecution started to pick up. But the Jewish community had been well established, really, in Poland, and the clergy's expectations about their demise didn't come easy. As a matter of fact, the Jewish community continued to flourish for most of the 16th century. Between 1500 and 1648, the Jewish population of Poland grew from 15,000 to 50,000. That's quite a bit. It's quite a bit, especially for that time of history. And they were granted an almost complete autonomy from kings such as Sigismund II. Jewish education and Talmudic studies reached such a level of excellence during that period of time that they would influence European Judaism for years to come. Now, there's always been a certain amount of jealousy from Christians, and even more so back then, because of the lack of education, and when you see Jewish people being displaced from one country to the next, you know, basically being thrown from one country to the next, and they fall back on their feet, and they get into business, and they get successful. Jewish people have a sense of business, okay? That, I'll give you that much. This is not a stereotype, okay? This is a fact. This is not, I'm not bragging. Jewish people have a sense of business. So we're very creative, we're very resourceful, and that probably contributed to the resentment that Christians that were struggling built against the Jewish community. And of course, we continue to see, not as much as during the Middle Ages, but we continue to see money lending through that period of time where Christians were very bitter about borrowing money from an unbelieving entity. So that didn't help, on top of that. In spite of a noticeable period of respite, ritual murder and host desecration accusations continued to occur, having found a fertile soil in the new Jewish influx from Western Europe. Additionally, Polish Jewry experienced one of the bloodiest decades in its history outside of the Holocaust between 1648 and 1658. What happened during that time is remembered, one of the events of that time is remembered as the Chmielnicki massacres. That's point three on your outline. In April 1648, the Ukrainian Cossacks, a group of East Slavic people from Ukraine and southern Russia, rebelled against Poland / Lithuania. The reason why I put / is because on any given day, you would get up in the morning and you'd be Polish. And then, depending on which way you walk through the village, you might be Lithuanian by the end of the day. You never really knew. There was a lot going on back in those days. So I've got family from Poland. I've got family from Lithuania. And so it's very interesting when you talk to them, you talk about the history and the memories of that era, how people always talk about the borders changing on any given day. But they rebelled against Poland and Lithuania and proclaimed their independence. The rebellion was led by Bogdan Khmelnytsky and led to what became known as the Khmelnytsky massacres. Khmelnytsky is pictured there under that paragraph here. He allied with, got together with the Tartars and led the Eastern Orthodox Cossacks against the Polish Catholics and the Jews. They just thought, we'll go after both the Catholics and the Jews. The result of the massacres was the death of 100,000 to 500,000 Jews of Poland. And it's a great, even the smallest number, 100,000, is quite a bit. Now, nobody really knows the numbers. I mean, there's a lot of you read one book, one record, and another one, and say it's 100,000, 250. So I always go with the smallest number to be safe. So it's probably closer to 100. It could be more. But in the destruction of over 700 communities. Now, a community would also be known as, like a shtetl. A shtetl is a Yiddish word for a village. And a good picture of a shtetl, Fiddle on the Roof. That's the shtetl right there. That's a picture not only of the shtetl, but also of the pogroms of the late 1800s. And we'll get to that in our next section, not in this lesson. I would have to go back and look at the history of Poland. I'm not an expert on that, but I would say that I don't know if Poland was that depressed at that time, but when they came, they brought a big boost to the economy. That's what the books are saying. So if I would assume without extrapolating too much, that if the reason why they were accepted so well was the boost to the economy, I would assume that there was a certain level of poverty and struggle at that time of history that would be welcoming an influx of people bringing knowledge and quality people and finances as well. But I don't know. I know that Poland turned on the Jews. That much I know. But I don't know a whole lot about Polish history. So I guess I didn't answer your question. Okay. So the Khmelnytsky massacres. They're both against the Poles and the Jews. The atrocities perpetrated against the Jews were far more violent. A lot of Polish people died. The Jews also were killed, and all the records of the massacres that I read, I just could not believe the level of creativity in the atrocity performed. I read one account of some Cossacks cutting the stomach of women and putting a live cat in them and then sewing it back. By the time you cut the stomach, she was probably dead already. But just the idea of going through all that, just for fun. A lot of those things were picked up by people like Dr. Mengele in the camps in Auschwitz. Experiments on twins and things like that. So those guys were pretty violent in their massacres. The intense massacres only lasted about a year, but it was enough to get a lot of damage done. Around the same time, the Jewish people are now finding themselves again. There's a lot of loss as a result. A lot of losses as a result of the Khmelnytsky massacres. Jewish people again are going like, okay, we're not wanted here. What do we do? And you know, it's, you can almost hear, you know, the fiddler on the roof when the rabbi looks at his community and he's looking and he goes, now would be a good time for the Messiah to come. Okay? Well, this is kind of what happened at that time of history. The Jewish community went, now would be a good time for King Messiah to come. Okay? They've been waiting for the Messiah. Of course, they don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah that came, died for you know, the world, and is going to return a second time. Jewish people, mainstream Jewish people back then, as for most of them today, believe that the Messiah hasn't come yet. So they're looking for relief from any king, as they've gotten relief from different kings of Europe and of Poland, any king, including King Messiah himself. Then comes on the scene Shabbatai Tzvi. And Shabbatai Tzvi is going to proclaim to be the Messiah. How convenient. 1676, Shabbatai Tzvi was a Sephardic rabbi from Dulcigno, Montenegro, which is on the other side of the Adriatic Sea, on the east side of Italy, on the other side, southeastern Europe. And he started to proclaim himself to be the Jewish Messiah at age 22. It's pretty young when you think about it. That's my son's age. Went around saying, like, I'm the Jewish Messiah. And he had a noticeable following in Smyrna and other parts of Europe. And then he eventually attempted to make Jerusalem his new headquarters. Because, you know, the Jewish Messiah's got to, you know, if he's going to do the gig properly, he's going to do it from Jerusalem. You know, if he's read his Bible. So he went to Jerusalem, and the premise of the local community was kind of skeptical. They said, nah, we're not sure you're the new Messiah. We're not sure you're the Messiah. So he declared Gaza instead as his new headquarters. Many Jewish communities of Europe, including the newly decimated Jews of Poland, started to make preparations for a return to Gaza under their new Messianic king. They actually start packing and gathering their wealth and say, okay, we're going to move to Gaza and establish the Messianic kingdom and follow Messiah Shabbatai Tzvi. In 1666, he went to Istanbul to put the Sultan's crown on his head, just kind of like say, okay, I'm taking over. He was immediately put in prison. Did not stop him from continue preaching his message and to continue having followers. Eventually, under pressure from the Sultan at age 40, proving that he had been a false Messiah, he converted to Islam. He became he became a Muslim. So you have to laugh. I mean, there's no laughing matter, but it's pretty sad. But that's what happened. You know, he was the next big candidate for Messiah, for false Messiah, we should say, since the big one in the first century, Bar Kokhba. Who had been proclaimed Messiah by Rabbi Akiva, and of course he was also a false Messiah. And Bar Kokhba did not convert to Islam, but this Jewish rabbi decided that he was the Messiah, and when the gig was no longer lucrative, he said, well, you know, under pressure, he converted to Islam, and took with him 300 families, and I guess it's a little bit of a hybrid form of Islam, I'm sure it would have to be. And to this day, there's 500,000 Sabbateans, Sabbataians, in that area of the world that belong to this sect, and they are descendants of the people that originally followed Shabbatai Tzvi into this Islamic messianism, whatever you want to call it. But he was a false Messiah, and you know what's interesting to me about the false Messiah is that he is still part of Jewish history, okay? Even though he was a false Messiah who converted to Islam, I mean, how bad is that? Bar Kokhba is still not Bar Kokhba, but Bar Kokhba is not somebody that Jewish people are too proud of. Of course, neither is Shabbatai Tzvi. But Bar Kokhba was endorsed and supported and promoted by Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, if you look at a top 10 list of big famous rabbis of the history of the Jewish people, you have Shammai and Hillel in the Bible, and Gamaliel in the Bible, and then you have people like Rambam and Rashi. We've talked about those guys. Akiva is there. You would say the top 10 list of world famous rabbis, Akiva is still there. Yet, he led his people into following a false Messiah. Now you take a person like me, a Messianic Jew, who follows the real Messiah, and we're completely rejected for life by the Orthodox Jewish community because we follow the false Messiah. It seems to be a double standard. So it's just interesting that even Rabbi Akiva, when I talk to Jewish people, I say, wait a minute. You still speak very highly of him, and he's a contributor to Judaism, yet he led Jewish people into following a false Messiah. What if I'm following the real Messiah? Don't you think you want to listen to what I have to say? So, anyway, it's not fair. But life is not fair anyway. Okay, now, the next thing I want to talk a little bit about is Hasidic Judaism. Hasidic Judaism is a sect of Judaism, and it's still very much a part of Judaism today. After the messianic fiasco of Shabbatai Zvi and the pessimism that had infiltrated the Jewish community because of that and because of the Khmelnytsky massacres, Orthodox Judaism became divided into two sects. Those who favored Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, and those who didn't. Now, really, when I say Orthodox Judaism, it's not fair because, really, back then you should say Judaism. There was no such thing back in the days, like I said earlier, in a lesson, as Orthodox, Conservative, Reform. Orthodox, Conservative, Reform Judaism is a fabrication. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just a fabrication of the United States in the late 1800, when there was an influx of Jewish people. We'll talk about that further down the road. There was another split within Judaism, but that didn't happen until later. And in America, you don't even have Orthodox, Reform, and Conservative and Reform in Israel. You don't even have that in France today. If you go to France, there's two kinds of Jews: those who practice, those who don't. That's it. My parents are non-practicing Jews, and my brother-in-law is a practicing Jew. And my sister, depending on any day, she's either or. And a lot of them are that. I keep kosher, I don't eat shrimp, except when I go to a Chinese restaurant. But anyway, I'm not pointing the finger at anybody, but that's a fact in Judaism today. But back then, Judaism was Judaism. You were a Jew, you had to walk to the synagogue on Shabbat, you had to keep kosher, you had to keep wear the Jewish garb, and you're either Jewish or not Jewish. At that time, we have a division within Judaism over those who favored Kabbalah and those who didn't. And Kabbalah is basically Jewish mysticism. The one book that everybody reads when they're into Kabbalah is called the Zohar, which is a compilation of writings that are all about mysticism. You can find deeper meanings and things. There are, when you study Kabbalah, you also study gematria, the numerology, when you apply number of value to everything, so mysticism is really Jewish mysticism, or any other mysticism is not of God. Okay, it's putting meaning in things that don't need to have meaning, and it's applying a lot of superstition and mystery to everything, and that's not what God wants us to do. Yet at this time we have a division within Judaism, and the way it kind of divided is that on one hand, southeastern areas of Poland made of more small shtetls and having less access to the yeshivot, the Jewish religious schools, favored the teaching of the Kabbalists. There were more little shtetls, little villages with less learned people and less access to what was going on and the greater schools of learning. So they were interested, like more of the masses, into what would they could relate to, and superstition and the village traditions and things of the sort. So in that area, you had they would favor the teaching of the Kabbalists. On the other hand, areas such as Lithuania in the north, where Jews lived in densely populated areas, where anti-Kabbalistic teaching could be found there, you could find the anti-Kabbalistic teaching in the schools, in the yeshiva. Much pessimism had hit the south after Khmelnytsky and Shabbatai Tzvi, while Lithuania had remained mostly untouched. Judaism was growing weary of rabbinic formalism and was looking for a way out of the rigid regulations of the rabbis, the fasting, the penance, spiritual sadness, the strict aspect of the Mosaic law. Kabbalah and mystic practices proved to be just what many Jews were looking for at a time when nothing was looking up for them. So that's when it got developed. The founder of the Hasidic movement is Israel ben Eliezer, is the picture on the bottom of the page here, also known as the Baal Shem Tov, the master of the good name. He was the founder of the Hasidic movement. Hasidic movement is still very much alive today. As a matter of fact, one branch that's very active today of the Hasidic movement is known as the Chabad Lubavitch. There is a Chabad house, they call them Chabad house in Irvine. There is a Chabad house in every city in the world where there is a reason for them to be if there is a sufficient amount of Jewish people that they can reach out to. The Chabad house, it would be our equivalent of an outreach to the community. You can't say that they're evangelistic because the word in and of itself carries the meaning of taking the evangel, taking the message of the gospel. But they are outreach-oriented. They go to the Jewish people that are not affiliated with a synagogue. They invite the Jewish people that are not practicing to get back into the things of Judaism, to get back to the fold. A lot of people, Jewish people, that are not going to synagogue today, that are not, it's expensive. If you want to go to the synagogue for the high holidays and you don't belong, we don't tithe in synagogue, so you have to buy a membership. So if you don't belong to a synagogue, you want to go to Yom Kippur to a synagogue and get a good seat, it could cost you several thousand dollars. So Chabad makes it available for people to come. They're non-affiliated. They bring them to. So you see a lot of people at the high holidays. Where do you go for the high holidays? Well, we go to Chabad. They're not religious. They're not practicing, but they're superstitious enough that they have to be somewhere for Yom Kippur, and they're not about to drop $2,000, so they'll go to Chabad. And the Chabad is pictured as a religious center. It's a Jewish community center when you have language classes. On some of them, you even have like a little dispensary, like a doctor. It's like there's a lot of different things, and there's always a family running the Chabad, known as the emissary, the husband and wife, and usually a few kids, and they have Chabad in China, they have Chabad in India and Africa. Wherever there are Jewish people, and they see that there's a need to bring them back to the fold. The one on in Irvine is on 5000 Barranca. It's a big big synagogue in the center. So the Chabad came out of the of the Hasidic movement. Hasidism is based on four principles, and on page six here, just as a little overview here. Revival, piety, refinement, and demystification. In Eastern Europe, revival. In Eastern Europe, Hasidism came to revive the Jews physically and spiritually. It focused on helping Jews establish themselves financially and then lifting their moral and religious observance through its teachings. Piety. Hasidism demands more piety than Orthodox non-Hasidic Judaism. Refinement. Hasidism teaches that one should not merely strive to improve one's character by learning new habits and manners. Rather, a person should completely change the quality, depth, and maturity of one's nature. And demystification. In Hasidism, it is believed that the esoteric teachings of Kabbalah, and believe me, they are esoteric, can be made understandable to everyone. There are a lot of teachings in Kabbalah that you read and you go like, I have no idea what this is talking about. And if you pray, if you do all kinds of different religious practices, it can be demystified, but it's accessible to everybody. But it takes time and faith and prayer and whatever else they say it takes. But I would stay away from Kabbalah. And by the way, the Kabbalah that Madonna is into is a little different than Jewish Kabbalah. It's based on it, but it's the modern version. New Age Kabbalah, yes.
So now this, the
Yes. Yes, 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 yes. Now, again, in Hasidic Judaism, the Chabad Lubavitch comes from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and then that line was basically one village and one, you know, from one village, and then from that rabbi you had a son who had a son who had a son, and basically the last rabbi who did not have a son was Rabbi Schneerson, who died in Brooklyn about 14 years ago. They proclaimed him to be the Messiah. He never proclaimed to be the Messiah. They proclaimed him to be the Messiah. But he was not born in... Well, plus he was not born in Bethlehem. He was not born of a virgin, and on and on and on. But he didn't have a son, so the Chabad Lubavitch basically does not have... There's nobody after him, so they're going to have to be creative, and they will be when it comes to the next person, because there's always something. Yes? Well, that's part of Kabbalah.
Yeah, as Kabbalah.
Yes, this thing that people wear with the hand. Yeah, I forgot the Jewish name for it, but that's part of Kabbalah. Yes, Jewish people, a lot of Jewish people wear it. They don't even know what it is. It's just a Jewish symbol. It's a Kabbalistic symbol. It's like a good luck charm. It's a Kabbalistic symbol, and I would stay away from it. But that's me. So to this day, we still have a great divide between, you know, modern Orthodox and Hasidic Jews. And within Hasidic Jews, you have a lot of pro-Zionism, against Zionism. Remember the Nuteri Karta, that guy Rabbi Weiss that we showed you a couple of videos of, the guy who believes that, you know, Zionism is racism and Jews should not go back to Israel. And so he comes out of the Hasidic Judaism lineage. So you have a lot of different trails out of Hasidism, but Hasidism was an attempt at making Judaism more accessible, not by simplifying it, by making it more appealing to people and less constraining. Yes. Right, right. Yes, yes. That would be a...
It's like making Christianity easier for you.
Right. And, and Hasidism did not necessarily make Judaism easier, because Hasidic Jews still believe that they were under the Mosaic Law, all of the 613 commandments. It's just that there was deeper meaning, and it was like an inner circle of knowledge that made them, you know, feel a little better, and it was not as rigid and as pessimistic as Judaism had been. And on top of Judaism being a hard religion on the people, on top of that, the whole world hates us. So, you know, what's left, you know? So, anyway. Conclusion. You never thought I would get to that word, huh? Conclusion. The Jewish community of Poland never recovered from the massacres. For those still surviving, life became progressively worse as they were starved and impoverished, indebted and heavily taxed. The Jewish communities of Poland once again became at the mercy of, at the mercy of acts of anti-Semitism. Riots started to get organized by Jesuit students in Poland from neighboring schools. As ritual murder and host desecration accusations increased again, so much that Jewish community appealed to Pope Benedict XIV, who called for the protection of Polish Jews in 1758. As a matter of fact, ritual murder and host desecration accusations did not diminish in intensity during the Counter-Reformation after Martin Luther, or even the European Emancipation. Those two things continued. The host desecration and the ritual murder of killing Christian children to take their blood to make matzah. I was watching a documentary. I was going to bring it tonight, and then I'm not doing it. But I'll tell you about it. It was it's called, and you can probably find it on YouTube. In several parts, it's called The Greatest Hatred, and the first part actually did a good overview of everything we've done from the beginning until about this class, or maybe a couple more down the road. But at one point, you see a church in Eastern Europe And I don't remember where it is. It might very well be in Poland, but I'm not sure. A church in Eastern Europe pulling a mummified child with Orthodox Christian garb on him. It's about, you know, 3-4 feet tall. And then they put this child that looks, you know, like a mummy, you know, like pretty skinny, like looks kind of scary. It's on a pedestal, dressed up like a doll, and then they put it on a pedestal in the middle of the church. And they put behind it a gold aureola, a big gold aura behind it to signify that that child has been canonized in the year so and so. And every year they pulled that mummy of the child who is supposed to be a Christian child that was killed by Jews for his blood to be used to make matzah. To this day, every year, there's a date when they celebrate that child's death.
And where do they do this?
In Eastern Europe. It's in that movie. I'll have to go back and look at where it's from. Lithuania, Poland, I don't know what country. It's one of those countries.
Wow.
To this day. Yeah, there are relics in all churches all over the world. And I love this quote. I don't know who said it, but I read it once. Somebody said that we have recovered enough wood from the cross that we could rebuild Noah's Ark.
Wow, Jesus must have been really big.
Hey, but that's the point. That's the point. You know, I just love that quote because that's what it is about relics. And I was like, oh, come on.
You know.
That's right. That's right. So, the 16th through the 18th centuries proved to be a very difficult time for the Jews of Europe. A few periods of respite aside, there was no place for the Jewish community to settle down without the dark cloud of anti-Semitism hovering over their heads. The European emancipation was around the corner, and with it, some changes would be introduced, but not enough to be considered any kind of improvement. Fix a typo there for me, please. Thank you. Especially for the Jews of Eastern Europe who would find themselves confined to a new, larger geographical ghetto with an imperial Russia known as the Pale of Settlement. The Pale of Settlement, we'll discuss that in a little bit more details because it deserves a chapter of its own in this class. The Pale of Settlement was basically a geographical ghetto. You look at the ghetto in Venice when they had like big tall walls around a small section of the town where Jewish people would actually go in and out and be confined to after a certain hour of the day or the night. The Pale of Settlement was an area, and actually the next page has a map. I believe you should have a map of the Pale of Settlement. It includes, you see towards the top, it says Vilna. Well, that's the capital of Lithuania. That's Lithuania right there. Minsk, I believe, is modern-day Belarus. So you see, I mean, it's huge. Kiev is what, Russia? So you've got, oh, Ukraine. Kiev is the Ukraine. So you've got all those, it's an area of about 1 million square miles. That includes 20% of European Russia, much of present-day Lithuania, Belarus, Poland, Moldova, Ukraine, and parts of Western Russia. And this was within the Pale of Settlement that Jewish people were confined for several decades. That's where the shtetl was developed even further, and that's where also all the pogroms, the government-sponsored riots by the soldiers of the Tsar, were performed in the late part of the 1800s. So we'll talk about that actually later. We need to stop right now. This is the end of this lesson, and then let me stop the recording, and then we will take questions.